such a beautiful day, if you're in Stillwater, you can walk from the Minnesota side to the Wisconsin side almost on the boats across the St. Croix River today. It's that beautiful. A little steamy out there, but a gorgeous early August day. We bid you good afternoon. Sam Turner with you here. Thank you so much for your company. Look who's with me today. My Monday through Friday all dedication request line guy, Tom the Shoe Man. How are you, Tommy?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good,
How'd you get roped into this today?
Well, it turns out Kyle had two weddings to go to today. So he gave me a little text about 8 o'clock this morning.
Oh, man. Love all that notice, huh? Two weddings, both his?
I sure hope not. Or maybe I do. I don't know.
You know,
you make me think this morning, jumping across the boats all the way over there.
It's 2014, Tom. Anything can go these days. Okay.
I'm thinking about that James Bond thing where he runs across the alligators across the lake.
He did that, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah. Did you see his feet afterwards? Well, okay.
Oh.
Well, folks, here we are. Thank you, thank you for your company today. We always try to bring you informative programs here on the Saturday show. And along the way, we hope to make them entertaining in the sense that they do get your attention. Hope they deserve your attention. We don't like to do subjects here that, while important, bore you to tears and make your eyes glass over. We can guarantee you we will not give you such a program today. We have a good one for you, a really good one. And I'm going to start it this way. Why should we care? Why should we make any effort to know and understand? World War I was a long time ago. It started in earnest 100 years ago this very weekend. We see it, if we see it at all, in grainy film footage and old history books, although there are a lot of new ones out there, but why bother? Here, 100 years on, we of 2014 have our attention drawn to current ongoing wars and conflicts. Syria, Gaza, Afghanistan, the conflicts in Iraq, and on and on and on. After all, is there any real connection between the world of World War I and us today? The answer is a profound and astounding yes. For the next little while this noon, we'll show you why. Our guide is a man who knows the subject profoundly well. Nick Hayes is a professor, a historian, an author. Nick Hayes, professor of history, who holds the university chair in critical thinking at St. John's University in Collegeville. His writings have appeared in a wide range of publications, everything from the scholarly Slavic Review to Interview Magazine. His articles have appeared in the Moscow Times. Yes, Moscow is in Russia. Star Tribune, Pioneer Press, Newsweek International, Utney Reader, and on and on and on. And Nick received an Emmy in 1991 for his work on TPT's special report, Television and Democracy in Russia. I like to call Nick Hayes one of the great explainers. He has the gift, the talent, to tell history in a way we can all understand. No dust-dry academic lecture from this guy. Professor, you better not do dust-dry today. How are you, Nick? Good to see you again.
I'm terrific, sir.
All right. You are terrific.
I'm
That's
kind
why
of
you're
speechless on, after that introduction.
You're gonna
I hope you keep a recording of it.
Well, I will. I think the only way the payback can be, I know you're going to give us an explanation of this amazing and profoundly intricate thing we call World War I, but we're going to take it apart in ways our folks can understand. How much do Americans know or care about World War I? Nick, what's your take on that?
My general take is next to nothing. Public opinion surveys across the United States in the height of the Cold War, often the majority of Americans couldn't identify the difference between the First and Second World War.
The majority of Americans...
It was just kind of one general blur. They often got it confused, thinking we had fought Russia, not Germany, in these conflicts. I think to really have a consciousness of the First World War, number one, you have to be a German-American of three, four generations back. For them, it is a major figure.
Yes.
Secondly, many families were deeply touched by the war. So there were the story and legacy now of grandparents, great-grandparents who fought, and some died, some were disabled. But for the most part, we could do a vox pop on the street of Stillwater right here, and I bet... Well, I'll put money that the majority of people could not identify who the belligerents of that war were.
Amazing, yeah. I would have
to... Or why the United States was in it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's pretty much what I thought you'd say. To start things here today, with your permission, and it's probably too late because I haven't asked you before this, but what I'd like to do, to set the stage here, and it's apropos of what you just said, is to read, to my mind, a wonderful piece that Catherine Watson wrote a couple of years ago. Catherine Watson, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure, I know Catherine.
Catherine Watson, for many years, was the travel editor and a writer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. She's now working for MinnPost, the online news service, and Nick, you write for that.
Wonderful people working for MinnPost,
including you, yes. Catherine wrote a piece on after a visit to Kansas City, Missouri, which is starkly profound, very sobering, and I'd like to share it. It's not going to take much time to read it, but it's worth it. Catherine is, of course, a great writer. She has a great heart, and she this visit really got to her, and I'll tell you what it's all about. The MinnPost article's headline, Remembering the Other World War, a moving visit to our nation's only museum dedicated exclusively to World War I. She writes from Kansas City, Missouri. From the moment you open its heavy bunker-like bronze doors, the National World War I Museum here is a shocking place. It needs to be. The first shock comes just a few steps in, a bridge of glass that you must cross to get to the exhibits beyond. The effect is startling enough to stop visitors in their tracks. But what made me freeze on the glass bridge was what lay beneath my feet. Poppies, red poppies, a whole garden of blood red poppies, the artificial kind sold every year in memory of fallen soldiers. There are 9,000 red poppies beneath the museum's glass bridge. Each represents 1,000 soldiers, 9 million in all, the total number killed in what was then called the Great War. The poppies' bright round faces gazed cheerfully up at me through the glass floor, too pretty for what they represent. It's this innocent prettiness that made their meaning hit so hard. They call to mind the war's most famous poem, written in 1915 by John McCrae, a Canadian medical officer who later died in France. In Flanders fields, it begins, the poppies blow between the crosses row on row. Another shock is the simple fact that this is the only museum in the country devoted solely to World War I. The original memorial was a local idea, and the complex is still a locally run point of pride, civic pride. Congress gave it the national designation in 2004. When I toured the museum, I got to chatting with another visitor, a woman about my age. We talked about Veterans Day, then only a few weeks off. She did not like the holiday's name. I can't call it that, she said. I wasn't brought up that way. To her, this would always be Armistice Day. You know, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. I nodded. The coincidence of all those 11s had been stressed in grade school in every November of my childhood. That was the moment in 1918 when the fighting stopped on Europe's Western Front. But an armistice is not the same as a victory. It's really just a pause when opposing forces lay down their arms, but nobody really wins. They can always pick those weapons up again, and of course, they did. The Kansas City Museum takes the position that World War II was the next phase of the Great War. My fellow visitor agreed. The First World War didn't really end, she said, until the Berlin Wall came down. I'd never looked at it that way, but then, like most Americans, I hadn't looked closely at the Great War either, and now I felt ashamed. I did not understand until this museum in Kansas City told me that the conflict involved 36 countries around the world and 65 million soldiers. In 2006, a new, bigger museum was built into the hillside under the Memorial Tower. The complex is dedicated to keeping the memory of that distant war alive. Thousands of items are on display now, and every innovation in current museum design is in use. Detailed timelines, holographic images, old films and photos, animated maps, letters home, personal talismans, and relics of all sorts, from minuscule to ponderous, from a Yankee soldier's safety pin to a French tank with one side bashed in. One of the most shocking exhibits is a life-size, better to call it death-size, reconstruction of a direct hit on a French farmhouse by a 17-inch howitzer shell. The bomb crater's about 35 feet across and 20 feet deep. And when you stand at the bottom, it feels like being in a grave. Elsewhere, there's a wall of patriotic posters, ranks of uniforms, a hospital tent, original artillery pieces, a 1917 Harley-Davidson motorcycle, early aircraft poised overhead, a Missouri mule team, and reconstructions of trenches where figures of American soldiers struggle forever in the mud of the Western Front. Even Gary Cooper's Golden Oscar is here, awarded for his portrayal of Sergeant Elvin York, the war's most famous American hero. York himself talked Cooper into playing him in the movie. When I finally left the museum, hours after I'd entered, my sense of immersion in the Great War was so strong that I felt cold, as if I were emerging from a damp bunker somewhere far, far away from home. It took a long moment before I could absorb the warmth of the sunny Midwestern afternoon outside.
Brilliant.
Brilliant piece by Catherine Watson on a visit to the World War I Museum in Kansas City, Missouri. That's a very way a chilling piece, isn't it?
It's brilliantly done. She captures the tremendous lingering grief and tragedy of that conflict.
Wow. Do we have any significant monuments to World War I, Nick Hayes, in
Minnesota?
Washington? Well, no, in Washington, D.C. What about the nation's capital?
I'm sorry, I can't offhand pick up one on my memory. Many of our listeners probably know D.C. better than I, but I make a habit of visiting these kind of things. No. I always like, Stan, there's two things that I often mention about Minnesota and the war, just personal things.
Yes,
one I used to be kind of sarcastic about. For those of the audience like me that are from Minneapolis, or if you're familiar with South Minneapolis, we have one World War I monument that's at Lake of the Isles. It's the PV Fountain. And it was originally a fountain donated by the PV elevator magnet as a place for horses to find water. And it later was rededicated to the horses with the Minnesota unit that died in the war. And I too often in the past, Stan, admit I made kind of sarcastic, funny jokes about it, you know. I've rethought about that because a lot of the reading I've done this past year about the idiocy of the use of cavalry charges in the First World War. Do you know that, I mean, and we can talk about this later. The Germans put, in their initial offensive on the Western Front, over 40,000 horses into battle. The Allies, drawing up from the Commonwealth, bringing in horses from around the world, also in the tens of thousands. It is no longer so funny to me. I mean, to me it stands as a great metaphor of, you know, if we think of the cruelty to animals first, then we can perhaps think of the tragedy of everyone. The other is a personal thing with me. I teach up at St. John's, which was, of course, historically Stearns County, a deep, deep German-American community. I take my students every year to a site in the old St. Joseph, Minnesota Cemetery. I show them all of the German graves. One of the things I ask them, Stan, is, when did German cease to be the language on the markers? Little lesson, they discover World War I about 1917-18. It ceases to be. However, the deeply moving thing is, in the center, there is a crucifixion sign for a symbol. And of those from the city of St. Joseph who gave their lives in the two World Wars, World War I and World War II, I can't add up. I think it's 14 names, maybe more. They're all German names.
Yes. Yes.
It's just a beautiful, quiet statement. They were discriminated against, but they fought in bravely in disproportionate numbers. So on my travel log, those are the two anecdotes, two spots I visit. Mm-hmm.
I believe we have a World War I memorial at Minneapolis, the drive, Memorial. The trees, are planted in memory of the men who in Hennepin County, I think, fell in World War I. So we do have, there's a little tiny plaque on the state capitol approach, which I've logged many hundreds of hours down there. That used to do stand-ups for Channel 5 out front. Somehow I never saw it. It's minuscule. It's very small. That's what we have on our capitol approach to World War I. In the way of tribute. It needs a bigger profile. The war itself is getting a bigger profile this year on the centenary, the 100th anniversary. And we're here this very weekend, Nick Hayes. This is it. Tell us. Well, here we are, August 2nd, 2014, 100th flashback, 100 years ago this date. What's going on?
August 2nd, the Austrians are advancing into Serbia. They had attacked 4 or 5 days earlier in retaliation for the assassination of the Archduke. They were suspending due process in Serbia proper to do the interrogation themselves of what they believe were terrorist organizations organized within Serbia, funded by the Serbian state, carrying out terrorist activities within Bosnia itself. In the course of Bosnia and Serbia. In the course, to bring people quicker up to speed, so what happens? Serbia has an ally, Russia, who has ordered a mobilization the day after. Germany, the ally of Austria, orders a mobilization the next day. The key thing about the French also join in. The key thing about the date that's coming up Monday is the British decide to join the conflict on the side of the French. It was never clear, by the way, that Britain would actually find itself in a military obligation to France. Nevertheless, it followed the course, and that's what created
They've never liked each other very much.
The Kaiser deeply believed this. He said this to Winston Churchill. You know those French, you're not going to get along with them.
He's right.
So these old ethnic politics were there, but in an uncertain way, they tragically backfired in that sequence of events.
So this coming Monday, August 4th, Germany invades Belgium, and the United Kingdom declares war.
That's right, yes.
When are the first actual shots fired?
The guns of August.
August 7th, Battle of the Frontiers, would that be it?
On the eastern frontier, they begin about the same time, August 10th, mm-hmm. as the Russians begin to engage Prussian troops entering towards Poland. I don't know about August 7th, if I can help you on that date, I would say it's more like 15th, 14th.
Okay.
They begin advancing towards what will become, through the months of September, the Battle of the Marne.
All right. Battle. I was looking through the battles. This is mind-boggling stuff. Your eyes will glaze over. First of all, trying to put together the warring sides, the belligerents. If we can just do that in real simple form so we can set the stage here. On the side of the Allied powers, we have, as you've mentioned, France, along with Britain, and Russia, Italy. They come on board.
Italy comes on board, but it has the distinctive, dubious distinction of entering the war by choice. Italy was allied to the Central Powers, Germany and Austria. Right. It reneged on that alliance and later in 1915 would join with the Western Allies on their side by choice.
And 2 years after that,
Italy would be decisively wiped out at the Battle of Caporetto, which is a town then in Italy, today in Slovenia. 1917, April, we declare war, and our troops begin to appear, the first units in September of 1917.
So France, Britain, Russia, Italy, eventually the United
States. To toss in Turkey, the Ottoman Empire was allied to Germany and Austria in this conflict.
That's the other side, the Central Powers.
Sure, yeah.
So on the bad guys we're fighting, okay, the Central Powers, Germany, the German Empire, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, okay, mm-hmm, Bulgaria. Right. Okay, so there we have the warring sides right there. So here we go.
We could toss in later in the conflict, Japan would enter on our side.
Yes.
A small footnote.
Say that again. Japan?
Japan would later, at the end of the conflict, enter the war on the Allied side.
Wow. Think about that, folks. Think about Italy and Japan, how they lined up in World War II as opposed to World War I as opposed to World War II. We're going to take a break. Professor Nick Hayes, we are sorting out World War I. The main point here, why it matters to us today. We're going to spell that out for you. Nick is going to do that, and in a sense, he's already started. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Down on the farm, after they seen Harry, how yet gonna keep 'em away from Broadway, jabbing around and painting the town.
At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
99 Sonics are here on the ground. 99 Sonics are here.
Jenna.
You take one to town, drive it around.
Jenna.
98 Sonics are left on the ground. 98
Jenna.
What, Tom?
Why are you singing?
Well, I'll tell you, Tommy boy. Cue the music. The 2014 Sonic is here at Stillwater Motors. Now the 2014 Sonic is the only vehicle in its class that's built in America. And it's the only vehicle in its class to receive a 5-star overall safety score. Sonic also gets up to 40 miles per gallon. And if you want to see it, get down to Stillwater Motors.
Okay, this all sounds wonderful, but it's got to cost a fortune, right?
Wrong! It's only $13,190.
Get out of town!
I will, in my Chevy Sonic. Give them a call at 651-439-4333. Just off Highway 36 in Stillwater. Right on the corner and right on the price. Find them online at stillwatermotors.com. Now sing with me, Tommy!
99 Sonics are here on the ground. 99 Sonics are here. Stillwater Motors. Good people to know.
By Piccadilly, farewell, that's our square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
That's what the Brits and the Irish and the Allies were singing in World War One. Some of them singing as they went off to war, thinking, oh ho, it'll be a short one. I hope I get there before it's over. Apropos of that, I'm going to read something to you in a minute. But first, our welcome to Professor Nick Hayes, an expert on World War One. He is here today to tell us why we need to care about World War One, why it is profoundly important to us today, how it has impacted us today, Nick. And as we go along, this is a long ago war, but it's in a sense here and now, isn't it?
Let's begin. With an observation, Stan, we're still fighting it today.
How so? Tell us.
Look at Ukraine, look at Gaza, look at the Middle East. We are fighting over the legacy of that war in terms of an extremely imperfect peace settlement that was imposed, creating indefensible political boundaries across the Middle East and across Europe. Those conflicts have simply simmered and just reappeared in another form.
100 years on, and the wound is still festering. Worse than ever. I want to quote here, if I may, just a short paragraph from a book called The First Day on the Somme, the River Somme, mm-hmm. which was one of the bloodiest of many bloody battles on the Western Front in World War II. Martin Middlebrook, a British author who's become a friend of mine, I'm happy to say, and I think a wonderful author, he writes, Britain's stated war aim, and we want to say again, Britain declares war on August 4th, that's this coming Monday, 100 years ago.
And up to August 3rd, the Kaiser and King George thought they were negotiating a settlement. Okay. That it was preempted.
And by the way, they were related by blood, weren't they?
Well, three of the monarchs were cousins.
Bizarre, right. Britain's, according to Middlebrook here, Britain's stated war aim was to secure the neutrality of Belgium. But in reality, Britain wished to curb the power of Germany, whom she regarded as a growing rival to her trade, maritime, and imperial interests. It was for Britain a very popular declaration of war. The entire country, and beyond it, the empire, entered wholeheartedly into the conflict. For most of the men who wished to fight, there was only one anxiety, that the war would end before they could get into action. The popular forecast was, in 1914, at the beginning of this horrible war, all over before Christmas.
That's right. Home by December.
Isn't
and it's also extremely important for all of our listeners to understand. There may have been reluctance by the heads of government in St. Petersburg, Russia, Berlin, Germany, London, Paris. They had a certain apprehension. They really did not consciously think they were entering into a conflict. What's amazing, with the declaration of war, with the mobilization, the mass enthusiasm that transformed the character of the war. They didn't anticipate the volunteers that would turn out, the parades everywhere, the enthusiasm. Everybody thought this was going to be this final glorious war that would solve their national cause, or of the French avenge their grievances against Germany, and so on and so forth. They had no idea of the type of conflict that was coming.
It had all the electricity of a rock concert, a giant rock mm-hmm. concert at the very beginning. They couldn't foresee the horror that was in front of them.
The Czech-German author Franz Kafka, I think, writing in 1916, had the best comment on World War One. He said, I quote, "This war was caused, above all else, by a tremendous lack of imagination."
Amazing.
Nobody understood what this conflict was going to be.
They could have easily, maybe, with given the fact that the Industrial Revolution had put into the hands of the politicians, but more importantly, the military, the tools of mass killing.
That is right.
Is right. John Terrain, another British historian, says it was the Industrial Revolution which had produced the masses. It was the Industrial Revolution which made it possible to mobilize them, arm the masses, feed them, move them. This war, World War I, as no previous one, was dominated by technology. This was, above all, a war of firepower, the firepower of artillery, the firepower of the new automatic weapons, magazine rifles, and machine guns. Firepower filled the air and saturated the ground with projectiles and deadly fragments. To avoid them, men went underground into trenches, dugouts, and reinforced concrete pillboxes. To protect these, they placed aprons of barbed wire, thousands of miles of barbed wire, and thus they created an obstacle which only more intense firepower could destroy. So it...
One anecdote here, Stan, on the Industrial Revolution and the war, a key thing. Tsar Nicholas II of Russia had the same myopia as did the Kaiser, for example. They had approved the modernization of the army systems and the development of mobilization by train that would greatly accelerate the time in which the mobilization occurred and got to the field. Neither really appreciated that they no longer had what the 19th century had. You could order a mobilization of troops, and you still had 5-6 weeks in which to discuss. Both the Kaiser and Nicholas somehow never understood what they had done. When the Kaiser had given the order to mobilization on the 3rd of August, the night before, from Lord Grey of England, there was a famous telegram sent to von Moltke the Younger, to the Kaiser, who summoned in von Moltke the Younger, who is the head of his chief of staff. And it was directed to the Kaiser, and it said basically from Lord Grey, His Majesty King George sees there is a conflict in the family.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And he's talking about the three cousins, and he says he would be most pleased to negotiate a resolution, meaning between Tsar Nicholas and the Kaiser. The Kaiser said, oh, well, that's it. He calls in von Moltke the Younger, von Moltke is commander, and he says, oh, Lord Grey George is going to solve this for us. He said, sire, you gave the order to mobilization.
Oh,
at this hour, our troops have already entered Belgium.
These guys, the Kaiser, the Tsar, and maybe even King George V, were not the sharpest knife
in the drawer, were they?
I mean, these guys were and again, well, let's just say they were related by blood, cousins?
They're all cousins. They all
the
are...
The spawn of Queen Victoria.
They went to her birthday party every year together. I always use this as a test quiz. For our listeners, maybe you might want to Google this. Take a look at photographs of King George. And if you don't mind, take a look at photographs of Tsar Nicholas II. I always tell my students, Nicholas II looks more like King George than George looks like George.
That's true.
The Kaiser had his own kind of dramatic style of appearance, dress, and mustaches and all that. But George and Nicholas, I mean, they do look like brothers.
They do.
And they dress the same.
Right. To use the train, if we can do a metaphor, this was a runaway train by the time these guys, these heads of state are saying, maybe we better rethink this. This is just a family feud. It's too late. It's too late. The wheels are rolling. The thunder is thundering. The lightning is lightning. And the guns are firing. It's over. Right.
Except, absolutely. That was...
So you can't get those that train back to the station. It's just the bloodletting just progresses geometrically. Nick.
A second detail we have to add: the Germans never anticipated that the Belgians would resist. They resisted immediately.
Everybody had it all figured wrong, basically, didn't they? Hmm?
We can jump ahead to the Battle of the Somme.
All right, let's do it.
The intelligence that the British used was all totally wrong at virtually every step.
This is 2 years into the war, July 1st, 1916.
Yeah, their sense of where the German positions were, what the line... They didn't even have the barbed wire correct. They thought it was an older type of wire that they could easily pass through. They could not. So in every case, the intelligence was wrong. The strategic planning was all wrong of all parties. Everyone had a flawed plan. Tsar Nicholas, if the Russians had just thought, they should do what they always do best. Hunker down somewhere in western Russia, maybe Belarus, maybe Poland, and make it a long, drawn-out war of attrition. They probably, the Tsar would probably still be on the throne of St. Petersburg. Instead, they bought this idea of a heroic cavalry charge across Poland, rapid, and they did engage the German troops earlier than the Germans expected. But, of course, we can jump ahead. The Battle of Tannenberg, they're wiped out.
The movie, The War Horse, did you see it?
Yes, I think maybe that's what prompted my remarks earlier about horses.
We see the officer corps up on the mount there. They are, with their swords, going straight into firepower. They are brandishing their swords and going into certain death. I mean, and they're doing it almost proudly.
Oh, it's... Well,
this is crazy.
You know, well, here's where it comes from. There was a brilliant piece by Adam Hochschild in the New York Times last week, and he reflected on this. All of these guys had their experience from colonial wars, where they charged by horseback and decimated the natives, particularly in South Africa, or in the Boer War. These were these great gallant cavalry charges. None of them observed that the way to stop a cavalry charge would be barbed wire and a machine gun. You know, but they persisted in this. And to jump ahead, you know, I was reading this note on, you know, General Haig, the commander, the second commander of the Western Forces.
Yes, after French.
Yeah. Do you know that he continued in the 1930s to lobby the British Parliament for an increase in horse-led cavalry? And he argued that airplanes and tanks could only be auxiliaries to battles and things like that. They were just obsessed with this.
Go ahead. Okay, I want you to...
They had this image of them gloriously riding on horseback, you know, to victory. The other thing... given the nature of the war, the French, the front lines of the French and Austrian troops were both kind of a costume blue and red. You know, talk about being a target.
Would that be an easy target?
That'd stand right out. I mean, it was like it was more a glorious.
Tom, go ahead. You want to say something?
I was just going to say, yeah, I've been reading about this over the course of 3 years. They utterly changed their tactics from the cavalry charge. Then cloth hats instead of helmets, and 3 years later, they have, you know, metal helmets. They're using tanks, these things that had never existed before.
Well, the poison gas came right away in the beginning.
Everything just over a few years. Yeah, also, I'm looking at a picture of the Tsar and King George. And holy cow.
They are joined to the hip almost.
You're supporting me at my observation, I take it, Todd. Yes. I see the boys there,
And here we have these dunderheads at the top of the pyramid directing the war, these generals.
Footnote, as long as we just decided to trash General Haig for a moment.
a lot of people would join in the trashing.
He was closely connected to the royal family. To the court in England, prior even to his appointment. I mean, he was married to one of the ladies-in-waiting of the British court. Prior to his appointment, he had asked for and received the permission to report directly by letter to King George. Now, this may sound all nice to all of us, right? But King George had no military competence at all. Neither did Tsar Nicholas. I mean, so therefore what's going on is he's manipulating King George to his tactics and his position. And George is not he's bypassing any intelligent command structure or political process to justify his own notions of strategy in this conflict.
And you think about the poor guys in the trenches, all sides in this fight. They are the ones who pay the price for the rank stupidity.
The first Russian units were sent, usually, without boots, sometimes with boots, but the first units were sent without weapons. They were told, take the weapons from the Germans when you find them. I mean, and by the mortality rates on those units was 90%.
And the 90%. The social structure, especially in Britain, was very much alive. The officer corps had it best, of course. Again, Martin Middlebrook writes, the officers had the best and often the only dugouts in the trenches and did not have to undergo the trials of exhausting stretcher-bearing parties, all that sort of thing. He writes, those officers whose nerve gave way and somehow got rid of, the guys who collapsed in battle, the officers, they went to the rear or home to England. But for the private soldier, battle fatigue was rarely recognized as a problem, and men who suffered in this way were condemned to a private hell in the trenches until they became a casualty or cracked and committed an offense which sometimes led to a firing squad. A few of these men could not face the future at all and took their own lives. One must feel pity for those desperate men who, in the solitude of a trench bay, ended their troubles in this way. No figures for such deaths will ever be available. Suicides were usually posted as killed in action. And there's this word from one private, one British Tommy in the trenches. Toward the end of the war, we were so fed up, we wouldn't even sing God Save the King on church parade. Never mind the bloody king, we used to say. He was safe enough. It should have been God Save Us.
The sense of tragic irony and bitterness that came out of the soldiers is perhaps, in a cultural sense, the longest legacy of the war. As you're reading that, I bet, Stan, you and I both had to memorize Wilfred Owen's Dulce et Decorum Est.
Yes.
His reflections on the fighting in Flanders and the gas, and it ends with, "Don't repeat that old lie, Dulce e decorum est per patria mari. How sweet and glorious it is to die for your fatherland.
Country, right.
One other, as we're going through this and talking about the conflict of the two sovereigns, it's also, I mean, if you think, we're talking about class and the general staff, I was kind of looking at a little survey. Haig never had the humanity, I think, to be moved in conscience by what happened under his command. His predecessor, French, did. I'll give von Moltke, the German commander, on the Western Front, at least some dignity. When he realized right away that they had failed, when he saw that losses on the Western Front to the German side, he resigned.
Mm-hmm.
And
he did what an honorable soldier would do.
And another great story for all of our listeners, the commander of the Russian Western forces that drove towards Germany was Alexander Samsonov, excuse me. When he, at the Battle of Tannenberg, he basically lost the army, 80% casualties. But he wrote in his diary he could not face his czar, he could not tell him the truth. He wrote, he asked God to forgive him for suicide, mm-hmm. and he shot himself.
Mm-hmm.
In many respects, I have tremendous respect for those two, who at least were trying to send a message of the gravity and the horror of what was happening.
Not so General Douglas Haig. No way is he in that cauldron of...
He learned slowly. Tom kind of picked up on this a moment ago. I mean, he eventually did introduce tanks, for example, by September 1916. He did modify some of his tactics, but he was a peculiar man. I mean, he was deeply religious. He went to seances. He believed God spoke to him personally. He believed his troops somehow had the same kind of faith.
Somebody was intercepting the calls, yeah. I think.
We could jump ahead to our own commander, Black Jack, Jack Pershing.
Mm-hmm.
Note, number one, he had prior military experience in cavalry charges in Mexico and the Philippines.
There we go with the horses again.
He entered into the conflict on the French side. Two things that were striking. He didn't listen to anybody. He repeated the same tactics that had failed in 1914 and 15.
Head-on assaults, right?
Head-on assaults. Thus we probably sustained more losses than we had to. But you know why he thought our assaults would win, Stan? Americans are much better with rifles. They're good shooters. They know how to hit their targets. We're just better marksmen than they were. That's what he actually thought, you know. It's not a good chapter in the history of military strategy. The architects of this were, for the most part, uniformly abysmal.
This was a war, especially on the Western Front, World War I, a war of stalemate, a war of trench warfare, where the sides were not that far apart physically, but they didn't move the trenches, the front lines.
The French never moved more than 2 to 7 miles.
But the bloodletting never stopped.
Never.
It was just an absolute horror. It was hell on earth. We're with Professor Nick Hayes here, talking about sorting through World War I. We're talking about the war, yes, but why it matters, why it is relevant today.
Let me throw out another question. And we need a break here?
Yeah, that's okay. You go
real
ahead.
Quick.
We'll take our break.
Okay, you and I could have covered in more detail, but let's say we wrap it up here, that within the first 6 months of the war, it was obvious all military strategy had failed. From all belligerents, their strategies had failed. Now, we can excuse, in a way, we can understand how the leadership of Europe slipped into this war. Here's what I think, and this is the lesson for today, lesson two. Why, when you realized your essential strategy had failed, didn't you quit? That would be the real leadership, to realize there is going to be no positive political outcome from this conflict, just senseless slaughter. By 1916, why did they not quit?
What's the answer to that?
Nobody wants to report back to their country that soldiers have died in vain. And the heart of the First World War, Stan, I am sorry, is they died in vain. Listeners, look up a book by John Keegan, The First World War.
Yes.
If you're really in military history,
yes.
He defines everything perfectly readable, but he begins with a point. The lesson of World War I is it was avoidable, it was unnecessary, and it was pointless.
Professor Nick Hayes, World War I, why it matters, what are the lessons, all the rest of it. It's a huge subject where we're going at it head on here and trying to tell you exactly how it was and why it was and what lessons we hope to derive from it even 100 years later after the beginning of that terrible conflict. We'll be back right after this.
Let the good times roll at Mississippi Dunes. Not only can you experience one of the most beautiful Lynx golf courses in the country, but Mississippi Dunes is so much more. Did you know that Mississippi Dunes can host your wedding in an elegant outdoor setting next to the Mississippi River? Or that Chef Jeffrey makes Doc's Landing a superior dining experience? Or that Mississippi Dunes is a destination of choice for rehearsal dinners, graduation, or retirement parties? Mississippi Dunes. Book a tee time and let the good times roll at MississippiDunes.com.
At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
Trust and estate plans aren't only for the wealthy. This is Cameron Kelly from Cameron Kelly Law. A good estate plan will ensure that your family is taken care of and your financial goals are met, even if you're not there to make those important decisions. Taking an inventory of your goals and assets is a good place to start. Call me for a free telephone consultation and to get the process started.
Cameron Kelly Law. For your business, for your property, for you. Call 651-705-6277. That's 651-705-6277. Cameron Kelly Law.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
That was the song the Yanks, the Doughboys, were singing as they set off in April of 1917. Took them a little while to mobilize after the declaration of war, so by the summer, I think, in the fall, the Yanks, the Doughboys, were arriving in France to join that horrendous fight called World War I, the Great War, the war to end all wars, which, of course, it was not. Nick Hayes, professor of history here with us. Nick, thank you so much for helping us sort through this terrible mess that we call World War I.
Well, I'm excited to be here.
Well, thank you. Learning lessons from catastrophes, collectively, we're not very good at learning, are we?
Let's say there's three lessons that we should all be aware of. Number one, it was the product of a diplomatic system that, by and large, is still in place that failed. Secondly, the military strategies of all belligerents failed. It's almost impossible to think of how they could have imagined in this conflict they could have succeeded. Third, the diplomatic solution is, in effect, a roadmap for the majority of conflict of the subsequent century into our time.
So today, what we have, the messes we have, the conflicts we have today, many of them are rooted, in fact, flow from World War I.
They flow from the dismemberment of the empires that came out of that war, the attempt to recreate some different concept or political structure for these boundaries, and various interested parties that have intervened ever since.
We're going to have to fast-track some of this. How is it that the Allies came to vanquish the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, that this sort of thing? The America held back until 1917. The war, after all, began 100 years ago right now, so 1914. How did this come to be that we collectively, the Allies, got the upper hand?
I'm going to ask another question in a second about why Germany lost, but back to the point of your question. The end of the war came simply due to numbers and resources. Germany was, its domestic front, its production capacities was exhausted. The Allies still had a numerical advantage, especially after April 1917, with the coming of the United States into the war. Keep in mind, in the spring of 1917, Germany tried its last major offensive. It failed. Combined with that is the coming of the Yanks, and that simply meant in terms of numbers that the Germans would not be able to withstand them. But you know what the real question and this is, well, Stan, you should ask me, what happened on the Eastern Front? What about all those troops they sent against the Russians? Why did they not they had achieved victory basically on the Eastern Front by 1917 easily, and they imposed it in November 1918, just before the army.
And Russia's in revolution by that time.
Yeah, anyway. Russia's gone down the tubes.
Right,
it's signed a separate peace treaty. The real key, they then would have had the resources to turn the tide. They could have brought the forces back from the east.
Why didn't they?
Because they were afraid of revolution in the east. They kept their troops.
The Germans
were afraid of social revolution, which was already starting to break out on the German front lines and would break out in Berlin in 1918. So they felt they had to keep those German forces to kind of keep the populations there in order. So the result is, because of their fear of that social threat, they lost the last opportunity they might have had to turn the edge.
This sounds an awful lot like World War II, the way things
played out, doesn't it, though?
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. The similarities are...
And I think certainly your earlier observation that really from 1914 to 1945, we saw one basically sustained conflict over the same basic issues.
The war mercifully comes to an end. In November of 1918, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, as Catherine Watson so eloquently put it in her piece there. But what follows is an attempt to make a peace, but beyond that, to punish the warring powers, those that were aligned against us, the Allies. And this, again, sows huge seeds, doesn't it, for a coming cataclysm.
Well, keep in mind, first of all, the German command thought they had surrendered to Woodrow Wilson's principles, that Wilson had promised an equitable peace and no vindictive treatment and so on and so forth. That's what they thought they had surrendered to. So they always felt that there was, in effect, a betrayal there. There was a lot of rhetoric about an equitable peace, a lot of rhetoric about creating new national boundaries only conforming to the elected wishes of those concerned. In reality, it was a vindictive peace that dismembered the German, Austrian, Ottoman, and for that matter, Russian empires into ungovernable territories and new states. It punished the Germans as being responsible for the war. And that, of course, led to two obvious issues. Number one, economic reparations that Germany could not sustain and were not good for the global economy anyway. And secondly, you start giving one of the worst political causes on earth, in this case fascism and Nazism, an emotional basis, an issue, a grievance, and that could polarize German opinion. You can't just wish a country like Germany away. You can't just pretend it's not a military power, at least potentially. And they just somehow thought that they had finally vindicated the defeat of Germany. Germany would reduce to second-class status, and that was not going to be the case.
Whipping Germany, as the Versailles Accords did, played into the hands of nutcases like Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
War is full of irony. Is it true that Hitler, of course, was a soldier?
Yes, he was in the trenches.
He was decorated. Was he, in fact, saved at one point by a soldier who happened to be Jewish?
That I don't know.
This is a story that's been around. In fact, the name of the soldier is in several publications. And
I have to double check that. I've never heard that.
If so, what an irony that would be.
Well, his favorite novelist turned out to be Jewish, too. So,
who is that?
I would say I'm Junger.
Okay.
Wrote these heroic battle, about German heroic battles and this and that. He was a great fan of the Nazis and Hitler, and it was only much, much later that it was revealed after the war that he had been Jewish.
How the mighty are fallen. The empires, the monarchies that are laid low at the end of World War One. What are they, Nick?
Well, they're all of them. Britain's troubles start in Easter 1916 with things going on in Ireland. Britain would see, coming out of the First World War, colonial rebellions, the dismantlement of its global empire. France would hang on, but in an entirely weak position. In effect, France came out overextended. It would gain Alsace-Lorraine at the expense of Germany, a territory it could never defend and hold. It had mobilized its French forces from French West Africa, and once you train these men how to fight and get organized, guess who? They have another enemy, you as well. The Austrian Empire, I think, is probably the best. The Austrian-Russian empires are the two we might want to reflect on most. For all of its imperfections, for all of its chaos, for its wonderful diversity, I'm not sure we really wanted to see the dismemberment of the Austrian Empire.
Really?
Yeah. I do not see that in taking it down. If you look at the Balkans, if you look at that region, have we really come up with a better solution? I don't want to digress into Russia and the Ukrainian crisis. The issue of the political mobilization of Ukraine comes out of the... It was part of the Austrian Empire. It gets thrown over into the Russian Empire. And we could talk about the whole dissolution of Russia and the coming of the communist revolution.
And the Ottoman Empire, the Turks.
The Ottoman the Ottoman Empire was, first of all, was it that wise for us to support the legend of Lawrence of Arabia?
I'm going to ask you about Lawrence of Arabia, a World War I figure. What about him?
Well, the idea was that he heroically united the Arab states to rebel against the evil, corrupt Ottoman Empire. Let's step back a minute. At the same time, the Ottoman Empire was going through a secularized modernization under Kemal Atatürk. Might it have been better to leave the Ottoman Empire and let it modernize and become a secular Middle Eastern state intact as opposed to what we unleashed in that region?
Was Churchill responsible for that horrible hecatomb at Gallipoli?
Where the
Australians and New Zealanders...
Well, first of all, it was collective folly by a number of the commanders as well. But it was certainly, yes, it was his great idea that we could have a naval blockade, that we could easily assault it. Again, poor intelligence, did not have any appreciation of the tenacity and the defense systems that were there. And so 200,000, mainly Australian, by the way, troops lost in that.
At war's end, the Brits and the French especially carve up the Middle East. And Mesopotamia, which we call
Iraq.
We call Iraq today, which is a fiction of a country. They welded together three distinct regions there by the Kurds.
Legend has it, according to one aristocratic British diplomat, he drew the boundaries of Mesopotamia on a cocktail napkin one day.
Yeah. These are three distinct peoples by religion, and trying to put them together as Tito held together the Balkans at the point of a gun. That's what
I could elaborate if we had the time. It's exactly parallel. I mean, the whole idea of creating, we couldn't figure out what to do with all of the Slavic peoples of the Balkans, so we made up the concept of Yugoslavia.
And put a gun to their head to keep them together.
That's right. Yeah. And but the Iraq case is, again, all of these artificial boundaries, made up states, where there is no appreciation of the historic and ethnic and national antagonism.
Professor Nick Hayes, do we learn from history? I would say, given on the basis of what we have talked about here, we don't do a very good job, do we?
I have to say that when we look at the conflicts of the 20th century, we seem to be perpetually repeating the same mistakes and refusing to step out of our own political box and accept a different historic and geopolitical reality to what's there.
How many millions died in World War I?
Well, you argue about the total, they say globally about 35 to 40 million. Military casualties, they usually say 9 to 11 million. But that doesn't count in the Russians. If you add the Russians from 1914 to 1923, they had civil war, so on, Russians estimate 10 to 11 million on their part. So,
let us not forget the individual. The individual gets lost in these mass numbers here. A poem by British poet Lawrence Binyon. He wrote it in mid-September 1914, mm-hmm. just a couple weeks after the war started. It's called For the Fallen. I'm just going to read one verse. They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. We really must.
Beautiful. We should.
I hope we do. In just the last seconds we have left, what's the lesson to all this, Nick?
The lesson is for the education and political engagement of the population as a whole, number one, in military strategy. Very careful monitoring of what the diplomatic process is, and above all else, the recognition of we must find a better solution to the political boundaries that came in the wake of the European empires, and our own for that matter.
Before you go, a couple of books you can recommend on World War One.
To get in there, I recommend Margaret Macmillan's The War That Ended the Peace, Gordon Craig's The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Started the War. I guess I'm running out of...
Okay, for fun,
try Joe Sacco's book on the Battle of the Somme, a graphic novel. And Jeff Dwyer's The Missing of the Somme. And John Keegan, World War.
Barbara Tuchman, 1962,
oh, you have
The Guns
to know
of
that.
August. Guns of August.
That's just part of the canon. All conversations begin with that.
Professor Nick Hayes, we are blessed to have you in our midst, sharing your knowledge with us. Thank you so much today.
Well, this was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. You made it so. Thank you so much, Tom. Thank you. Everybody, thanks for listening. Why don't you grab some of those books that Nick mentioned there? I think they'd be worth your time, certainly. We'll see you Monday. We'll see you both of us here, won't we, Tombo? We'll
sure
see
will.
You for the All Request and Dedication program right after the news at noon. Bye-bye. Have a great weekend.